Today, I'm delighted to be talking to the one and only Hannah Gadsby, whose 2018 Netflix comedy special, Nanette, changed the comedy landscape forever.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue.
Well, good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm all right. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm smashing. What time is it there?
9 a.m.
God, that's early. I was about to whinge on about how late it was, but you've got the bum end of the deal.
Oh, no, I'm okay. I'm a morning person and I'm not working it. So
you're larkish. What time's early? What time do you get up?
Well, I only just got up this morning, but generally I'm chipper in the morning than I am in the evening.
I'm a slow burn. I'm a slow burn through to midday.
I'd be a lot different comedian if comedy was a morning situation.
Yeah, you must be sort of quite an outlier being not of the owlish persuasion.
Yes, yeah. Being a fowl, as my dad would say.
So gigs, what you're sort of thinking, I could probably just tuck myself up under the duvet now.
Yeah.
It's an unseemly time to start work, 7:30 in the evening.
Yeah, it's the getting home and socialising thing that I'm just, you know, I can get myself on stage, do my job, and then everyone's like, yeah, and I'm like, nah.
The beers okay. thing afterward, I've never been able to do.
Well, I've had to do the beers thing in order to do the beers thing.
Well, I used to do the beers thing too much.
Yeah.
And then I thought, there's an optimal amount of beers before it becomes problematic. And then it just becomes like a sort of covering mechanism for all the sort of kinks and chinks that I don't want people to see.
Yeah. Was it James A. Acaster who has that brilliant bit about being tipsy?
What's that?
He's just sort of like, that's what you want to be, but it's almost impossible to maintain tipsy.
Yes, once tipsy hits you, exactly. It's not a state that can be maintained. It burns out pretty quick. But the other way is you do the way you go, which is you carry on thinking, "Oh, this yes. sensation's great," into unconsciousness, which is how I very much the first 5 years of my drinking career were to blackouts because I thought, "This is fun. This is amazing. I'm the life and soul. I'm on a table. I'm dancing. Everyone thinks I'm great." Black. Where am I? And then I had to just stop. Yeah. So for years, I've been the kind of person who doesn't drink at all now.
Well, my problem was I didn't black out.
Is that your just way of saying you're tougher?
No, it's not tougher. It's foolish. Like, I just didn't, like, lose consciousness. And nor did I dance on the table. So I would drink a lot, but I wouldn't black out. But I wasn't fun. No one knows why I was there.
So that you're the opposite of every drunk I've ever known. You've become less noticeable.
Yep.
Less noticeable, more like a sort of, like an imploding star, a slowly imploding star in the corner of the bar.
Yeah, I am a black hole.
Well, then why do it? What's the benefit then if that's the way it makes you feel?
Well, I don't really do it so much anymore, but I think part of it was like you're supposed to socialise and I'm... You know, this is what you're supposed to do. Where I'm from, like, you know, drinking is the hobby, and that's how you socialize. And in order for me to socialize, I have to drink because I can't like it. Well, I don't have to anymore, but as a young person, it's because I'm incredibly sensitive to environment. So alcohol. And smoking made everything bearable. So, you know, I was less, my hearing was less sensitive, my taste was less sensitive, you know, I was able to cope with, you know, so in order to endure drinking, I had to drink.
I thought you were saying in order to endure people.
Both, yeah.
Yeah. Smoking, I quit smoking a while ago, but I was a good smoker in my time. And what's great about smoking is, it's a hobby for sure. It's an addiction, but it's also a weapon. So you can wave it and create this incredible space around yourself.
Yeah. The me circle.
The me circle. On which note, I need to apologise to you. We've only met once, I think. Possibly twice.
It's in Edinburgh.
in Edinburgh, and I've always felt very guilty about that because I was very affected by Nanette, which I saw at the Edinburgh Festival in the first iteration of it. But I sort of I found it incredibly moving and profoundly relevant in ways that we don't have time to go into, I imagine, today. But I just hugged you afterwards, and that I just sort of afterwards thought, God, not everybody wants your sort of desperate, tactile personality on them. And I just sort of wanted to apologise because you must have had a lot of that. You must have opened the floodgates for a lot of people.
Yeah, look, thank you for the apology. It didn't strike me as inappropriate at the time.
But now you mention it.
Now you bring it up.
Fuck.
Yeah, what the hell? Yeah, look, when I was performing Nanette, I wasn't really mingling. So I think a mutual friend of ours introduced us.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, like I used to just finish the show and scurry home and sort of do my dark star imploding routine alone and sober. And so I did have it, like I was aware that that's what it was doing. And a lot of people did do that. A lot of people did that and then forgot themselves. But generally speaking, it was, you know, it's at least I kind of knew who you were. Context is important. So a lot of people are just fans. Oh, not just fans. They are my bread and butter. So they're not just fans. I appreciate them. But as individual human units, I don't know them. They know so much about me and it makes me feel particularly vulnerable. And, you know, and then I've had to learn how to sort of get the me circle sans smoke around people who, you know, most people are generally just sort of like, thank you. And, you know, it's a brief moment and it's lovely. Like, I'm very grateful to know that I did something that affects people. Like it's all you can hope for as an artist, really can't. But other times there are people who just sort of don't have boundaries. And I hear a lot of trauma.
And yes.
It's hard. So then, you know, people are sort of like
offloading,
really offloading. And, you know, it's really difficult because you're just like, you poor thing. But then each individual comes up and shares something and then you're just like, I don't have enough.
No. And you can't.
So that's why I do it in bulk. I do it on stage. I do it in bulk. This individual interaction thing is.
Yeah, well, that's that makes sense. I mean, I just think what for me was I enjoy, the older I get and the more I understand my strange brain, the more I allow myself to become obsessed with the ideas behind things, the mechanisms, the workings, the TikTok, do you know what I mean? Not the jazz hands, but the real meat underneath it. And there was the simple equation in Nanette, which I found incredibly pleasing, which was the idea that comedy is based on the resolution of tension. And what if you don't resolve it? What if you let it just sit? And also we will shapeshift and bend the truth in order to get a laugh or distort, in your case, something incredibly painful and powerful to find connection. But actually, in being truthful and severing that faux connection, you're able to make a real connection, which, as you say, is with the people who've experienced trauma and suffering and all that sort of stuff. But I found it a masterclass, really, in examining the genre and how false but how also twisted and brilliant it is and how shortcomings are.
That was the surprising thing for me. And that's why I find it very easy to laugh off criticism, because that is not what I expected. I expected it not to work. That's why I put in the bit at the beginning. It's like I quit. So, because I know what's coming next is not comedy and it won't work. It was really I think because of what it became, people sort of think of it through a lens that wasn't part of how it was created. And that was created to my audience that I'd been building slowly for years, not the millions of people who watched it on Netflix. It's just my small audience in the, you know, UK and Australia. And I'm saying I'm quitting and talking to people who kind of come with me in my career. Hmm. And I thought by doing that, I will lose a good chunk of my audience, and then I would know who they were. And that, because I was starting.
So you were trimming down. I was
trimming down. Yeah, okay, a bit of topery.
Yeah.
A bit of audience topery, you know. Because I think I'd sort of become a little bit broad in my appeal, and I'm like, I don't know what to say and who I'm saying it to. Like, I'd go out on, when I first began, I kind of knew who my audience was, and then I got to this stage where I'm like, I don't know how to please these people. My story is so idiosyncratic, I don't know how to connect in a broad way. It's just like I have lived a strange life and strange things have happened to me, and I'm from an obscure place in the world, and I'm queer, and I'm, you know, and I've just been diagnosed with autism, and I'm like, I don't know what to say and who to say it to. So I wrote Nanette. And what's surprising is that this thing that was supposed to be like a smoke bomb and a repellent worked in quite the opposite way. And I found that so surprised that that story resonated.
Well, in pursuing the singularity, you achieve the communality of experience,
which you understand in theory, but in that practice, in the context of comedy, it was just like I didn't expect that to work, and how it makes me sort of, you know, it rekindled my belief in the, you know, the power of the stand-up stage and almost how it's been squandered for dick jokes.
Yes.
And which, don't get me wrong, they're important. They're a great icebreaker, but they shouldn't be the only reason you speak.
But also the as well as the dick joke, for me, a lot of Edinburgh hours were squandered on kind of sort of fake theses I should basically theme this show, and the themes were just there to tie up loose ends rather than having any, you know, sort of emotional potency. And I think not only did yours do that, but it came at such a particular time in history, in comedic history, in women's history, in politics and all those things, and it might have lit the fire, and if it didn't, it was one of the little fires that got lit all around the world at that time. That must have been an amazing thing. If you allowed yourself, I don't know if you did, but an amazing thing to be part of.
I'm starting to look back and understand what it was, because honestly, I was in the trenches. Doing that show was an incredibly traumatic thing in its own way. Ultimately healing, but as I was doing, it was just like, I was almost a zombie just going, it's the only thing I could do. And I knew it was doing something. You know, there was... You're just like, I know this is good.
Mm.
It hurts. It's painful. It's exhausting. I'll just keep putting one foot in front of the other. So I didn't have time to sort of think about it and contextualize it. You know, I missed the Me Too movement. I missed it.
You're too busy doing it.
I was just doing that show. And I had to log off social media, and, you know, I've never really gotten back onto it because it's too dangerous a place. I've just put it just put some sort of, you know, hate beacon on my head with that show. And so anytime I pop
did
my
you?
Head
you
up,
see, like... it's strange, isn't it? And obviously I have a very different perspective on it, but you got shit for that, did you? There were detractors, there were...
Yeah, but I think it's the comic's brain. You could get 100 good things and 2 bad ones, and that's all you see.
Hmm.
And that's fine. I just didn't... In normal circumstances, that wouldn't bother me. It'd be like, great, fine, let's keep moving like a shark. But I was exhausted and vulnerable, so I just didn't need to see that sort of stuff. So I'd clocked off social media. And it got worse once it went out on Netflix.
That's a strange... It got worse when it went out on Netflix. This is the most extraordinary sort of thing to happen at your own special. But no, it got worse after that. You're saying the detractors got worse.
Yeah, you know, the license. Because I think a lot of people just sort of saw that this is a Netflix special and thought that that's all it was, not a live show that I did for 18 months before it went out.
Hmm.
And I think also because of when people see something on Netflix, they go, oh, you're a success. You're a millionaire. This is, and it's
so we can,
like,
attack with impunity.
We can attack, and yeah. It's, and they do, and they don't. And it's, I just never have understood that. It's just like, you didn't have to watch. And it turns out not many of them did watch. They're just a.
Oh, no, that's one thing, like, I found is that people, you know, they don't need to see something in order to have an opinion about it.
Yeah, which is, you know, which is what we all do to a certain extent, because I think we feel like we have to have opinions. I think it's very rare you hear someone sort of say, yeah, I don't know what I think about that. I've started saying that, like, I just, like, it's, I'm training myself to, because I, you know, it's a novelty thing to say now.
Yes, or to admit you haven't seen something.
Yeah.
To admit that something's passed you by. I'm finding great joy in just going, no, I haven't watched it. I don't know who that is. Just busting.
Well, I've had to live that in real time, because a little bit, you know, I dabbled in the LA of it all.
You did dabble. Yes, you did.
Because it was that sort of, like, I set myself up and made some connections, and now I've run back to the country in Australia. I'm just living in a small town.
And is that safer for you? You feel happy at that?
Oh, it's much better, much the best. I don't I have trouble navigating social situations that with people I've known for years. And, you know, Hollywood is an extreme version of that, and it's fraught, and no one is it sounds like a cliche. It's like, no one's real. You can't afford to be real. It's just
there's no time.
It's just what it is, but it's not for people with autism. It's like, I'm too blunt. I hurt people's feelings, and they're so sensitive, and that's fine. Good on them. They're artists. But I kept meeting people, and I'm like, no idea who you are.
LA thing, in inverted commas, that you did? What's the after the Netflix special?
What's the most LA thing that I did?
Yeah.
Well, meetings. I did meetings.
Well, of course you did meetings. That's the quintessence of the LA experience.
My favorite. But I was having the meetings people would kill for. And I'd never dreamt of it, because it was never on my radar. Like, because you just look, I'm not a fool. Like, I have ambitions, but I've sort of maintained them in the sort of craft and the art of it.
Yeah, we grew up performing in caves in Edinburgh. You don't go from a cave to, you know, the man theatre.
So I don't sort of like, didn't go there like, you know, I didn't. And because Nanette was really a swan song in a spec. Mm. Like, it's not like I had like a cheeky sitcom in my back pocket. So there are these people like, what do you want to do now? And I'm like, I'm tired. So in a way, I kind of squandered the moment, but I don't think I did, because it just was too slippery for me, and I was exhausted, and I don't think I would have made a great decision even if I had a cheeky sitcom in my back pocket. But I was having these meetings, and it was just like, and I know, like, the, you know, I know people who's, you know, have been writing sitcoms for a long time, and, you know, I have friends who would just, I won't tell them of these meetings. They're the ones that they've been angling for, and they meet the, you know, entry-level gatekeepers, and here I am with the head of Warner Brothers, and he's taking me on his golf cart, and I'm like, this is wasted on me. Let me give you a tour. The head of Warner Brothers.
What?
Gave me
In a golf, what, round the studio?
Yeah. And I'm like,
sure it was the head of Warner Brothers and not one of those kids that just does the, you know, like the Universal
Taz. Stuff. It's Taz Devil. So it was kind of incredible. But we had this big meeting, and we tried to get the sizes down, because, like I said, I'm quite unable to do more than three people comfortably. And just keep track of what I'm saying and who I'm saying it to, and hearing everything that's going on. I have this thing as a auditory processing disorder where if I can't prioritize sound. So in a noisy environment, a really quiet sound is the same as the loudest sound. It just comes in and I can't sort out the importance. So I really struggle, hence the beer. But you can't take beers on meetings.
Not in LA, you can't.
No. Well, they can't. Don't even do tea. And that was the thing about this. Because they'd seen the show and they're like, oh, you want tea? And I don't think they expected me to say yes. Because they're always, you know, taking these great big, you know, cartons of coffee around, chugging it back. They're very busy people. And so they had that facility. I could have had a big, and I'm like, no, I really like a tea. I didn't think it was too much to ask, but apparently it was. And the head of Warner Brothers.
What's interesting about those meetings, though, is they want to know, what do you want to do? And there's no friction. And I don't you think that sometimes you need the friction to make the art?
Well, I found the friction. That's my gift.
You? Yeah. in the cart.
Yes, because it was in the room and it was like they had this massive table and they filled it up with a lot of people and he's like, I'll make you a tea. And everyone's just like, what? He's making the tea. And so then there was this kerfuffle.
Is he showing you it could be normal? He's going, I can be a regular guy.
It worked. He was really sweet. I mean, he might have, I don't know enough to have an informed opinion. I don't know what I think about it. But he was nice to me. He was very lovely. And he filled the paper cup up with boiling hot water from the urn, like whatever place, kitchen. I don't know how it works, but it was boiling hot. Like it was just, and then this tea bag in it and then milk before it had, you know, so the milk was in before the tea.
That's wrong.
So it was just, you get it, right? And it's fine. I was like, oh, God, but I couldn't even hold it. It was so hot. And then it started melting the glue that keeps the cups together because it was so hot. And because usually, I guess they have coffee in this boiling hot water situation and milk, and so it cools it down. But this cup was melting as everyone's introducing themselves to me around the table.
Vice president of.
Yeah, and I met the dude who does the, they had the reality TV stuff people in. Reality TV.
Structured reality or augmented reality.
Yeah, and I'm like. Yeah. I don't know why you're here.
I'd love to see
But good on you. And they're like, you know, a few of them are just like, oh, you know, I'm involved in The Bachelor. And I'm like, cool.
Wasted on both you and me, that. It's not right? Something we're going to do.
And so, but one of them said, oh, I'm involved in The Bachelor. It's very popular in Australia. I don't know if you know that. And I'm like, I've got this burning hot tea that's melting onto this mahogany table. And I'm just like, I don't know when to say something about this. And then she said, it's very popular in Australia, The Bachelor. I'm not sure about Tanzania.
Okay, well done. Yep.
And and so half the room were like nodding and the other half knew that I'm from Tasmania, not Africa. And so they're just like, ugh. And I'm like, oh, it's Tasmania. My cup's melting. And then it was over.
Is that it? So there was just basically slow eruption of boiling liquid, a geographical correction. And then.
So that was my meeting with Warner Brothers. They were lovely. And I'm like, what I learned is that it's just a process of schmoozing. Yeah, then there's other meetings, follow up meetings. And everyone's so nice. Which
so
is
nice.
Difficult to navigate because I think it is that friction. There's nothing to hang on to.
. 2020 was the year from hell, and for those of us who struggle with stress and anxiety, a new year doesn't necessarily mean everything is going to get better, but that's where Grass & Co can help. If you've listened to previous episodes of the podcast, you'll know that Grass & Co is a premium CBD range that blends the highest quality CBD with therapeutic botanical ingredients. The organic CBD and botanical formulations have been specially created to relax your mind and soothe your body. For many people who've tried CBD oils, they believe that the challenging taste is just something you have to put up with to enjoy the benefits. But Grass & Co disagree. Their CBD is blended with all natural botanical ingredients, including ginger, turmeric and orange, or ashwagandha for the deliciously smooth flavour. To find out more, head over to grassandco.com/hour. If you're new to CBD, the best-selling 500 milligrams Calm CBD oil is a great starting point. As with all supplements, CBD affects everyone differently. So start low and steadily build your dosage every day so you find the balance that works with your body. For me, the Calm CBD Balm is the product. It soothes my aching joints and gets me motivated while I'm in one of those lockdown moods. Grass & Co. have supported the podcast since the start, and you can now get 25% off the entire Grass & Co. Calm, Ease and Rest CBD ranges. Plus, you'll get free shipping. Just head over to www.grassandco.com/hour and use the discount code HOUR, that's H-O-U-R in capitals, at the checkout. Grass & Co. Life enhanced by nature. From Tasmania, but you've done a lot of your comedic learning, it's fair to say. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, in England, in Scotland, in the UK.
It's a lot of friction.
A lot of friction. And that's what makes you. It's the fact that that a lot of times you can do a gig where the hecklers are, in my case, funnier than me. And I'm like, yeah. I've learned from you tonight. Because if they can be civil as well as funny, it's a gift.
It's, yeah, it's the hostile ones.
It's yeah. The hostile, but the hostile ones usually witless and you can deal with them. But, you know, it's that sense of, I want to know that I can't before I start to, almost like I'm the block and the friction is the chisel. And then we'll start to make from the animosity or the criticism, positive or negative, that I get, something will be hewn.
Yeah, look, I think both worlds could learn from each other. You know, there's pros and cons to both. Like I feel like there could be a bit more positivity in the UK. There could be,
especially in the moment.
But also risk taking. There's not the risk taking, the investment in new talent in the UK that you see in the US. Like they're actively on the hunt for new talent that's not been sort of, you know,
broken.
Nurtured from the beginning, you know, like there's a stepping stone out of the Edinburgh Fringe that if you don't go the right path, then you're sort of, you're old and broken before it, you know, like, because they're looking for the next new big thing. So I sort of saw that happening in Australia and the UK with me. It was just like, I was on the cusp, but I just got no opportunities. I did, you know, people don't know what to do with me, and it's fine. I don't know what to do with myself either.
But you did. You created a show that, well, admittedly was born out of defeat, but I mean, paradoxically, as with all the things we've discussed with that show, it's your greatest victory. It's, you know, it's when you finally perhaps let go and said, ah, I'm done, that you were able to speak from a such a powerful, truthful place.
But, I mean, on that same lens, it's like I still had to share the Edinburgh Award.
That was difficult for me to understand, I won't lie. And I'm going to be true to what I said earlier and say I don't know either the gentleman in question and I've not seen the work. But I do know that you can't laud something for being a sort of a blazing sort of meteor of new wave comedic feminist sensibility and then ask that person to share it.
What was interesting to me on the, you know, he's all right. He's an all right guy. No offense. It was just the moment. And I felt kind of bad for him, for John as well, because it's like, and it happened in Australia. Another of my friends here had a really cracking show that year. And I saw him and I said, look, I'm so sorry you had your good, great show this year. And he goes, no worries. Don't worry, mate. You know, there's this thing with the Edinburgh Awards where people are like, it's my time, you know, and that's what he was. You know, there's politics with awards that are weird and I've never understood them. And my place was mixed up with what had happened the year before, which was another show that was apparently not funny and about sexual assault. But it was a really odd moment to sort of share the stage with 10 men. And Nika Burns on the comedy, because she was hiding behind a sign, because you had all the League of Gentlemen. Is it League of Extraordinary Men? It's League of Gentlemen.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, because they were there to give
hand
you all over.
And they won in 95, I think, or something like that. Yeah, they're amazing.
So that, yeah, great and really lovely guys, but there's a bunch of them, and then there was, John on stage, and it was just like me and a bunch of blokes, and I'm sorry, I just sort of remember thinking, didn't do much here, did I?
But you have to see beyond that. You have to see. I mean, what I took from that actually is, it's about your show. That show is also about collusion. You know, it's about as an audience, you create an energy and an expectation which sets the template for a comic. You know, this, you know, as a herd, this is what we want. And then when someone has the temerity, as you did there, to go, well, maybe you want something different because I'm not going to give you what you think you want, then it shifts.
It was a look, I'll stand down on that. That show was bigger than me. Like, I knew what I was doing in the beginning, but as I performed it, I understood that I was unlocking things in an audience that I didn't fully understand. And I think it's important to recognize that. Like, I had ideas about what the show was, and it was crafted to the best of my abilities, and I'm incredibly proud of it. But it happened at a moment and in a world that was bigger than me. So,
is about that, the way that you describe performing it, because you performed in, you know, dozens and dozens of, you know, major cities around the world. It seems to me that every night on some level you were re-experiencing the trauma. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. There's a protection that comes with repetition, but I'm not a performer. Like, it's not the same as acting.
No.
There's not a protection, and I don't do that. But there is a protection that comes with repetition, but I understood that. So I never... The whole show is really finely crafted except for the last 10 minutes, and I never locked those in.
Oh, okay.
So if you were to see the show more than once, you would never experience the same 10 minutes at the end. There was about 30 minutes of material that I would pluck out. So I was very much... So the reason I did that was to keep me in the room every night, because I felt like that was the responsible thing to do. You cannot phone that kind of trauma in. Like,
no.
I had a responsibility to be and understand what the room was every night, because I was... It's a dangerous thing to do to, you know, that's why they have trigger warnings, you know, to... and part of the show was about, like, you don't need trigger warnings if people cared. Like, if the performer cared about what they're talking about. Like, it's not throwaways, it's not there for a tool to laugh, it's just like, it is about that tension and that trauma, and part of the show was an experiment in that. It was like, the reason we have trigger warnings is because we live in a world where people don't care about other people's traumas. It's just jokes.
Yeah, it's not experiences.
But, yeah, so by keeping shared. That, yeah, by keeping that last 10 minutes absolutely live, I felt like I was able to be, you know, keep that responsibility. So there was, you know, so that though was a double-edged sword for me, because it meant that there's dread and trauma. Like, as I'm doing the show, like, I'm
back.
I'm uneasy.
Yeah.
I think that the performance came into that.
See, I think part of me just grabbing you afterwards, it wasn't really a grab, but it was a hug, but it was partly, I suppose, a wordless acknowledgement of stuff that we perhaps share in that regard, but also an intense desire to try and make it better. And I think, you know, I think that's great to be able to, as an audience member, have that emotional afterburn in a show, whatever kind of show it is. You want to carry a dialogue on, or you want to try and change something. If not, you know, I didn't know you, so I couldn't change, or I could change your experience, but it didn't stop the impetus to want to make something that I could change.
Yeah, look, I think there's a there is something in this that I think older queer women have. There's a blind spot in our culture to our experience. I think the coming out story of, you know, is mostly about men from, you know, the male experience. Apart from Ellen, but like when she came out, I didn't even know. Like that's, I was stuck in my corner of the world. We didn't even, you know, her show didn't come reach my TV, and then she was just known. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't. There's no friction there.
No, because she's already well known and well loved. And not to try to belittle what she may or not have gone.
Oh no, but it's that American story that's not mine. Like it's not.
Yeah.
Like America hadn't quite homogenized our culture by that at that stage. But that's all well and good. But it's just sort of like that sort of like the female coming out story is different to the male. And I think that's been rolled into one as, you know, but I just, because the pressures, and it's changing, the pressure on younger women is different than the pressures that old, and I just felt like, you know, that story had been lost in a way. So, you know, you know, there is a gender distinction with the coming out story that sort of I felt like I hadn't seen reflected. So when people like yourself and as there was more where you just sort of like, you know, I would look at you and go, oh, you're doing fine. I'm not doing fine.
I wasn't doing fine.
No, that's why it was kind of great. It's just sort of like, you know, no words really had to be spoken. We're just like, yeah, oh, I get it.
I mean, most of the time, I was doing fine.
Oh, yeah.
But there would be so many casual assumptions made, you know, in print or out loud that would just be like burrs. I mean, there have been bigger things than burrs for both of us, but the burrs are the thing for me because they're just everywhere. And you just think you've got rid of one and then there's another one. And they're small and almost insignificant as of themselves. But when they mount up, they just, over time. And I think you're absolutely right. I think the lack of true visibility and singularity in female coming out stories was really important for you to address.
Yeah, there's this grass seed in Australia that's a native here that looks like a coronavirus, but and it's sort of green and it's got these red spikes and my dog got one on his face. But then you're just like, oh, that's a funny little, and then it explodes. And so then all of a sudden you just, and he's like Velcro, so he's just covered in these things. And that's when I saw that, like it's just this one thing. And that's, I think, what people think of when they just say one thing to you. And then you go home and then all of a sudden it's just, spreads, and it's because you haven't healed the trauma. So when someone is a casual or a tiny little barb or something, and they think it's, and that they think that's all it is.
Yeah, because they haven't got the understanding, perhaps, that there have been countless people before who said similar things. Or sometimes it's just a negligence. Sometimes it's just almost the absence of comment rather than, or not knowing what to call. I mean, this has changed now, but, you know, 10, 15 years ago, not knowing what to call a partner or stopping talking about sex because they think, oh, this is awkward because how can you contribute? Or, you know, things like that. It's just like, this is crazy shit.
Yeah. Like the amount of times I've had men wanting to know how I classify sex. Like, how do you know when you've had sex?
Obviously, no one's asked me that.
And I have to admit,
I kind of wish they had.
I have mis Like, I have spread misinformation. Because at the beginning... Because
I've heard some terrible things. We knew that it came from that hemisphere.
I just go, if you believe this, you can just fuck off. Like, I've told people that, oh, we carry around... You know how chefs carry around knives? In there, like, they roll it out and they got a knife for every occasion. Lesbians have one of those full of dicks. Because that's the only way you can have sex is with a dick. And I say it in a way, I'm like, this is obviously a joke. And they're like,
so like a knife roll full of dicks.
Yes, a knife roll. And I have people come back to me going, knife roll? And I'm like, oh, wow.
You see, you could go anywhere with that. You could say, well, we have a special duct. It's a secreting duct. And when you've had sex, it emits a very strong lemon flavour that will fill a room like an air freshener. And if you've not experienced that, have you not experienced that with your girlfriends? And then you could leave them wondering.
It's new car smell.
Yeah, then they would wonder. No, girlfriend's never emitted. My girlfriend's secret duct has never emitted.
You need to try harder, buddy.
I don't know. I kind of... This is the thing, though, for me, is I think... Now I'm sort of older and I don't know. I quite... There are some aspects of the secrecy thing I quite like. I kind of quite like people just not knowing. I quite like being on the outside again. Just not to say I want to be persecuted or hurt, but do you know what I mean? We're still outsiders, even though we're on the inside.
Look, I think that's almost the responsibility of older people.
I love how I'm now being deemed an older person.
Well, I deem myself as an older person because it's like, I think, you know, from your teenagers to about mid-30s, you should be wondering who you are and what you need to do. After that, you just like, you should be going, how can I best proceed?
How can I calmly proceed? That is my thing.
Yeah. Okay. Because it's like, I think, like, so many old blokes at the moment who've been wonderful in their day are really getting sad about cancel culture. And it's like, dude, it's culture and you're not it anymore.
No, it evolves.
It's like, let go, you silly old men.
You can still have fun. It's just you don't have to be at the front of the ride all the time.
They're not in control anymore. And
you say that, but we're recording this on the day after, a few morning after. An old white man managed to almost smash the fundamental pillar of American democracy. I mean, there's still a lot of very powerful dudes out there. I wouldn't say it's the end of the white guy. Not what, like, I wish it to be, but there's room for
everything. There are a lot of old white guys who were part of that mob, and the reason they weren't stopped was because they're old white men.
No, I mean, as many people have commented, if that was a Black Lives Matter march, then the whole Capitol building would have just been sprayed with gunfire at the end. But that is the thing, is that is the way you look at that and you think, that is the conclusive proof, if proof were needed, that the corruption goes to the heart of everything.
Yeah, I just don't, like, I think it's a really great thing to understand, you know, I think you should be able to weather the system and you should be able to, you know, proceed gracefully. I like that.
I enjoy watching things that someone, you know, watching pieces of work that have been carefully curated and crafted and marvelling at them. And I feel greater joy at that than watching something shit. I don't feel envious when I watch something wonderful. I just think, God, good for you. You have raised the bar.
What's something nice that you've seen recently? What's something that you've...
Well, I suppose the thing that made me really trill was I May Destroy You. And because I just thought I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know how this is, I don't know how this is going to be framed. I don't know the colours. I don't know the smell of it. I don't know the bandwidth of it. It's not my world. It's younger and it's, I don't know, of course, fresher, but I learnt everything from it and I found it just very powerful and instructive. And that's in the same way as Nanette, you know, it's...
I'm obviously old.
No! But you're not old, and this is the thing.
Nah, I've got 10 more years. 10 more years than I have to.
All right, what are you going to do with them then?
Well, I'm writing a lot. I like writing. Yeah.
What are you writing? More stand up? Or have you got cheeky little sitcom?
Cheeky little sitcom in the back pocket. No,
it's set in a zoo. I play the head zookeeper.
There is something nice about the idea of creating a sitcom and living that world for, you know, a number of years and creating a family. You know, there is something, but I haven't come up with an idea I'd want to live with for that long. The beauty of stand-up is it's ever evolving. And after my raft of meetings in the US, I decided on a model career, and that was Laurie Anderson.
Oh, so
I just sort of think, you know, I was hot for a minute. To maintain that kind of heat, you have to do all sorts of things that are way outside my comfort zone and would necessarily deplete my energy to be able to, you know, like say, you know, coming up at around the same time with like the Queer Eye Boys, who are wonderful, but they are so present. And I have to go back and be invisible and work and craft, and I can't, you know, like what I do is slow. I'm a slow twitch. So that sort of Laurie Anderson for me appeals. Like I can just keep, you know, every other year come up with a new show and tour it and craft it. And then I can build, you know, I'm curating working with a museum to curate an exhibition. I'm not sure I can say any more about it. Writing a memoir, which should come out at the end of this year. I've written a television script, just an episode, which is in the works. So you just send those off and other people read and make decisions. So who knows where that'll come. So I toyed with the idea of doing a podcast, but that again is... I have to be really guarded about my energy because it's, you know, it's like,
is that an autism thing? Is that an ADHD thing?
It's autism. You're a finite resource.
I understand that. I have ADHD, but I understand that part of your neurodiverse brain, but yeah,
you would. I have ADHD as well, and it's, the learning how to withdraw and is a really valuable skill. That's how I've decided to, and I've bought a, you know, lovely little place in the countryside outside of Melbourne. And, you know, I've decided that, I have enough. And so whatever I decide to do is, I don't need it to survive.
So that sounds like the questing is over. I mean, not in, you know, that you know, so much of early showbiz is questing. It's the knight errant, isn't it? It's going into foreign lands and trying to convert people. And it's good. It's good. I sort of think once that questing drive's done, actually some of the best work starts.
Yeah, look, I'm comfortable with that. And also I think, you know, it's important that I think, you know, I started a fire a little bit about, you know, showed a different way of doing stand-up. And, you know, I think it's really important for someone like me to move aside and let other people use the fertility left in the soil. You know, like there's no point me just keeping that whole space for myself. You know, that's not going to do the craft and the art form. I can still do my thing, but that questing, you know, as you call it, it's like I feel like I've achieved an enormous thing, and I don't feel like I need to repeat it.
That's the good thing about ADHD.
Right, isn't it?
It's so good. I don't know about you, but I really can't stand Obviously, in my time, I've done a lot of presenting, and there'd be the sort of auto cue. And a lot of the time, I would have had a hand in writing what was on it. But if something went wrong for whatever reason, I did something wrong, or there was technical problems, I could not read the same thing again. I would have to make something completely different up, which would drive everyone nuts.
And
yeah,
it's the authenticity of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I have to feel something to know that it's real. So all the world around me has to be experienced through sensation. And if it doesn't mean something, the risk of saying that, but in my heart, it doesn't have a vibration that is emotional, I can't get it. It might as well be in Mandarin. I don't understand it.
It's just sounds.
It's clacking. It's exactly, yeah. It's breeze and it's movement, it's noise. It's just clacking. Whereas, you know, I can, you know, go halfway around the world, not share a language with somebody, but they'll just do something and I will be overwhelmed by this sort of sensory connection, and that's all I want. And then I'll happily just turn around and go home again. It's like, I understand that. I understand you, I think. And we get each other. And that's all I wanted to know, is that you knew me for who I am and I know you for who you are, and we can go home.
Yep, off you pop.
But don't ask me to repeat. Don't ask me to have that experience and then there was a problem with the camera and we have to do it again, because it's dead then.
Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah, we're live performers though, I think, ultimately. That's a live performer thing. I mean, you must have learned a lot doing presenting.
I suppose I had to... It's taken me a long time to work out how to be me on television, I think.
Yeah.
I think I started off, but you think we all have our baggage. And I think for me, so much stock was placed on me as a child to succeed academically, because I came from parents who were clever, but had had nothing, had no advantage and had left school early. So therefore it was important that I just, you know, and I'm the eldest child, you get the qualifications, blah, blah, blah. And then I go to a smart university and all the rest of it, but then I don't go into a proper job, which must have been very disappointing. But I spent so much time, wasted so much time not being me, not being authentic, because I wanted to try and be clever. And actually, you know, I'm okay, you know, I'm not the dullest tack, but neither am I the sharpest, but I'm somewhere in between. And that's, understanding that and being okay with that, meant I was able to be authentic, and that you know, like me or hate me, at least I know that you like me or hate me for a genuine representation of who I am. Because in the early iteration of me, you know, I would get criticism and I'd think, oh God, who knows if that's true or not, because I'm so far adrift. And a lot of that's got to do with what we were talking about, you know, the sexuality and acceptance, my own levels of shame, which were just catastrophic, I think, in retrospect.
Yeah, the shame is profound. And I think there's an intersection between being neurodiverse and a queer woman. And it's a lot of hot footing around going, am I doing this right? I'm not sure I'm doing this right.
Where's the template?
Yeah. And because because I couldn't alter the way I was. But I tried and I didn't understand that I was failing. So I thought I was being, you know, like just like everyone else. And then I'd have someone say to me, I just really admire how you don't care. You know, you're just who you are. And I'm like, holy shit, what am I doing wrong? You're just who you are. Who am I?
Yeah. You're the imploding black star drinking too much in the bar. And I've got my trousers down on a table.
You're still here, people would say. Oh, you were there. Oh,
did you have that? So that you'd...
Yeah.
So in your head, you're the life and soul, and they've gone, I didn't know you were at that party.
Yeah, because I participate, but just by watching and observing and taking all the information in. So I'm like bearing witness, which is a very active role.
Yeah.
But nobody remembers that because they're being actual active. A friend of mine described me well, I think. It was just like, you like punctuation. You're sitting quietly and then, you know, and then all of a sudden you'll say something which illustrates that you've been here the whole time. Like, oh, I love a callback. You know, it's my gift in conversation. So I start rolling in things people say earlier and going, oh, that's like when you said that before. And, you know, I get, that's how I'm able to participate. It's just like, just callbacks.
So you see the threads.
Yeah.
And you want to just put them into a bow.
I don't know. It's just what my brain does. So I don't know if I'm necessarily making a bow out of it. I'm definitely making patterns.
Oh, I love a
And
pattern.
connections.
And should I tell you the joy that I have discovered having struggled with my attention issues is that as a child, for example, I had no interest in maths as I didn't understand how one would want to be curious about it and struggled to get any sort of qualification. I think I probably ended up getting something. But in later life, I've come to see numbers as really beautiful and part of sequences, patterns. They have a shape to them. They have and they have a music to them. I'm obsessed with music and structure of music.
Do you play
And
music?
I do quite a lot. Yeah,
Do you, have
yeah.
you always played music?
I played almost obsessively the piano when I was a child because I was so shy I didn't speak. So I played a lot of quite.
Babe, you probably are on the spectrum.
It's been said, but there's too many labels at the moment. You know what? It's.
It's not, don't think about it as a label. Just think about it as a comfortable place to be.
Oh, it's totally comfortable.
Because it's like you're just saying very similar things. It was
What I
the
like to do is I like to play music which, for example, has triplets in one hand and then just sort of two, so three shapes in one in my left and two in the other. So you're basically your right and your left brain is almost at war trying to make these two almost disparate rhythmical elements fit together.
because I'm learning piano. I've just started. I'd never had anything to do with music my whole life. Just wasn't in the world I lived in. And at the beginning of last year, I started learning.
That's great.
And it does wonderful things to my head. Like it feels good in my head. Like sometimes it hurts my head, trying to get the coordination. And I'm obsessed with music theory, the bark of it all.
This is everything. I did. I have this sort of benign lump in my brain after a lot of MRIs. I've spoken about this before, but I don't need the dye they put in you anymore because I can just see sheet music and play it and look at the architecture of it on the page and it will light my brain up. And that's what it's doing to your brain. And actually, I don't know much about, neuroplasticity, but you can, as you say, feel it when your left and your right hand is trying to do something together. Your brain has to connect on a level that's just above and beyond anything else. It has, it won't have worked like that before.
Sometimes I think, and this is not true, but I like to think of it in this way, is like autism is like reverse dementia. And because you're just such a slow starter in life. People are, you're wrong-minded, you're simple, you can't, I couldn't speak, like I could, but I couldn't. They call it selective mutism. I just call it like it's too much, I'm not going to talk. It's not a decision. I just lost the connection between my brain and my mouth because there was too much going on, too much input. I had to shut down the output. But the older I get, the more powerful a tool my brain sort of becomes.
And you give yourself permission for it to work the way it wants to work.
Well, I think it's about developing language for yourself. Like I always used to say, like English is not my first language. I don't know what my first language is, but it's like it feels like I'm constantly translating. And it took me a long time to work out that I have to be well rested and have a lot of, because people don't necessarily believe that I would have autism because I can be social. But that takes a lot of rest and care in order for me to function. It's like being the duck. My brain is like that. But because I'm such a placid appearing person,
No one would know.
no one knows. But the older I get, the more joy I'm able to find in my own thinking, and I feel like that's why I say it's kind of like reverse dementia.
Piano thing, I love the fact you've I could have spoken for an entire hour just about that, but another time. It's really the architecture of sound for me is takes me to a place of peace, but also inquisitiveness simultaneously, which is a very hard state, I think.
To find a mind-body connection is quite, I've always found quite difficult, because I'm always quite happy to live in my head, but the connecting it to sort of a bodily existence has always been a struggle. But piano sort of hits that sweet spot. Boxing did the same. I
do a lot of boxing now. That's the lockdown thing for me, is hitting a man called Dan.
Oh, Dan the man.
He's just lovely. He plays Frank Sinatra. And he doesn't humiliate me for being weak.
No.
And he'll sometimes say, go on, babe, give us a liver shot. What's not to love about that sentence?
Yeah, that's better than blackout drunk, isn't it? Just hit Dan on a liver shot.
So you box in a gym, you box at home?
Yeah, I just have a couple of things. I used to, you know, I had lessons back in the day, so I keep my hand. Oh, but it's okay. About sort of keeping my mind active. Like, I can't do mindless stuff.
No, so it's that's why I like boxing, because it's like he'll call out the shots and you have to remember, okay, well, my feet need to be in this certain position and my weight needs to be there in order to uppercut and then jab, jab, hook.
If I can see that there's an infinite and impossible to comprehend underpinning to something, I'm in. So piano is impossible.
There's no mastery.
I'm in, because that's where my brain wants to go. And like, so like boxing and gardening, it's just like you're never going to know it all. The garden always has something to teach you.
And also you can apply what you think's best practice and it can fail and you can't work it out.
Your garden always tells you though.
But I have attention for the garden is not good. It's not, and I know it would relax me, and I know it would be good.
I think you just have to get obsessed with it. Like, as soon as you find your obsessive point with it,
but I'm obsessed with crochet at the moment, which is absolutely mindless crafting. So I've got the boxing. I do a lot of minimalist pianos, a lot of Philip Glass, Steve Reich, Nico Muhly, anything like that. Loops, patterns.
Ice wide shot.
Exactly that. All of that. Look into all of that. And then...
Oh, I'm just, still learning.
Just, you can do it. And then just making enormous blankets. But then, just as they're about to be finished, we're talking about huge things.
You don't finish things, do you?
No, I leave them. And there's just coils of now quite dusty, nearly completed woolen things that I leave in the museum of me.
Yeah, I can't start and I can't finish. So I've learned how to force myself.
That's okay. At least you have to complete something. It's not. If you don't start, then the completion isn't an issue.
Well, unless you're under contract.
That is true.
So I'm fucked. I've been writing my memoir for 12 years.
Okay.
And because how can you write a memoir? You keep living, and then your perspective changes.
Oh, they don't want to know about your perspective.
Well, they do. Imagine if I handed in the book I wrote 4 years ago.
Yes, that's true. Like, what I mean, they don't want to know. Your readers want to know, but your publishers don't want to know.
Yeah, well, we'll get it out.
Yeah, you just need to. It just needs to get done. You need to do this one thing, and also you are a finisher completer. You've created two Netflix specials.
But live is different. Life is different. Life is always alive, so it's never finished.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, you capture it on film, but still, that's a live wire.
Don't ever read it back, right? I wrote a memoir, and it can stay on the shelf. But if I had to pick it up and do a reading a few times, and I was furious with it, and I changed it as I was going along.
I'd do that. That's how I write. Like, I read it out and then I'm like, this doesn't sound right. I'm gonna reading it out loud.
Rhythm. You've got to get the rhythm right.
Yeah. Do you know how because I still struggle with speaking, do you know how I make sure that I know how I'm saying things on stage is with drum beats? Like, I put my headphones on, I'm fine, and then find the perfect rhythm to say a thing.
And so that's how you can almost learn the words from the rhythm.
Yeah, because if I have to think about the words, that's why the last 10 minutes of Nanette was such a potent thing, is because sometimes when I, you know, like I struggle to talk when I don't know exactly, you know, like in those moments. So, but I mean, I did have pieces. There was a puzzle. So the last 10 minutes had 30 minutes of things I could say, but they fitted in different orders and I could take that bit from that bit. So but the phrasing was always there. Yeah. So I need to have, no, the phrasing's the same. It's just the order and how the order to other bits.
Yeah.
And the length I take to say something and the pauses and the emphasis you can play with, but the phrasing is all, and I do that by using, you know, it's like if country music met rap.
Now I'd like to I'd be down for that album if you're looking for another project. Okay. Yeah, Hannah, she's got in a new direction. She's doing, it's kind of country, but there's a bit of rap in there too. It's not finished. It's not, we don't know when it'll be finished.
You gotta know when to hold them.
There's a joke that I remember hearing when I was little, which you've reminded me of. It's not a particularly good joke, but it seems to me it's about...
Glad I could remind you of it.
No. Not in that way. Not in a bad way. But it's about English people's view of Germans. But actually, it feels a joke about autism, really, about its truth. So that, I'll tell you this, too, you think of it. So there's a German family. And the daughter, Astrid, is born and she doesn't speak. She doesn't speak for years and years, and Gunther and Maria every night go, Astrid, are you okay? Is it you're nothing? Nothing. And it gets to say that Astrid is 8 and they're sitting down for family meal and they serve dinner and suddenly out of nowhere, Astrid speaks. She says, this strudel is dry. I go, oh my God, Astrid, this is extraordinary. Why are you speaking? And she goes, because up till now, everything has been perfectly satisfactory. And that makes me think.
It's autism.
It's an English, classic English joke about the functional precision of Germans. But it's because also.
Because it's like.
Everything has been entirely satisfactory. Why speak? Yeah. Why fill the fucking room?
Yeah, that's pretty much. It's like, well, it's all right.
Yeah, I'm glad you, that just occurred to me when you were talking about selective mutism. I just thought that reminds me of that joke, which is strange because I never remember jokes. I'm really glad we got to speak and I'm really grateful for your...
What are you drawing?
This is by no way any reflection on how fucking brilliant you are, but I do this all the time.
I do a doodle. I'm just wondering what your chosen doodle is.
Always that. It's just sort of almost like seed pods, almost.
It's a fir.
Yeah. Let me just try.
Is that a Douglas fir?
It might be a Douglas fir.
Douglas fir seed pod.
There you go, seed little pods. What perfect simplicity! I've got whole books of them. Whole books of them. It helps me focus my mind when I'm talking. I hope we see each other in the flesh when this madness and sadness is over on the global stage. I will come and see a show. And I will not hug you afterwards, but I will have a beer and watch you disappear into a black hole.
Yes.
And then we'll talk about piano.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
I'd like that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was joyful.
A huge thanks to Hannah, and both of her specials, Nanette and Douglas, are available on Netflix now. As always, the music in this episode was provided by Waiting for Smith, and you can find all of his music on YouTube and Spotify. When I'm down and I'm blue, all I do is stare at you. I'll be heading east to find my peace, where the desert feasts.